My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man.
Hello and welcome to the Post-Credit Pod. I am Brandon Katz, Senior Entertainment Reporter for The Observer. I'm here with Eric Italiano, Senior Entertainment Editor at Bro Bible. And today, in honor of Tenet, we are continuing our deep dive into Christopher Nolan's blockbuster filmography. Today, we're jumping into the one and only, the best, the magnum opus, the masterpiece that is The Dark Knight.
What would you have me do?
Endure. You can be the outcast. You can make the choice that no one else will face. The right choice. Gotham needs you.
A little fight in you.
I like that.
Then you're gonna love me. Now that's more like it, Mr. Wayne.
All part of the plan.
I know Eric is excited about this, visibly frothing at the mouth.
My entire life has built to this point.
As it should, my friend, as it should. But before we start our conversation into that and get into our classic awards and categories for The Dark Knight, we want to tackle, you know, the stories of the week. What's hot? What's trending? Today's headline is that Jonathan Majors, who fans know from Lovecraft Country and Defy Bloods, has been cast in a lead role for Ant-Man 3. Last week's major news was the arrival of the Dune trailer. We're going to start first with the MCU, where Majors is said to be playing fan-favorite comic book character Kang the Conqueror. Eric, I am excited for this because it represents a few key hints at the potential future of Marvel, specifically the potential introduction of the Fantastic Four, and setting up a Young Avengers project. And we can jump into the hows and the whats and the whys of those two. But first, what was your immediate reaction upon reading this news?
Well, let me just add to what you said. Not only can it pay off a few ways in terms of the way that the MCU could add characters from here, but it pays off in a storytelling way, because Kang is sort of a time-traveling, multiversal type character. As we've seen with DC, they're starting to lean into that multiversal type way of telling stories. So the MCU can now do that too. Kang's name has been out there for a while now, along with Doctor Doom, Green Goblin, Galactus, as sort of being the MCU's next big bad.
Yeah, he's like the Thanos replacement of sorts.
Now, from what I understand, and I've tracked this story sort of since the start of the year, Kang's name has been out there for a while now. He's going to be sort of a bridge villain between once they get to the Doctor Doom and the Galactus in Phase 6. From, again, this is not confirmed, just what I've read and what I could sort of tell by the way it's being set up. So he'll be sort of like a, you know, like the Phase 5 guy. Perhaps as big as Thanos. I certainly don't think it's going to take as many films to like get to the payoff of his arc, but I do think that he is going to be in more than just Ant-Man 3 and is going to be the Avengers' next like big foe.
Yeah, I agree as well. I do not think this is a one-off villain, and it comes back to the two things I mentioned. Number one, the introduction of the Fantastic Four. Now, in most iterations, Kang was born as Nathaniel Richards, who is a descendant of Reed Richards, who obviously is Mr. Fantastic in the Fantastic Four. And the fact that they cast Jonathan Majors, of course, there's a lot of time in between these two birth points, but that does suggest that perhaps the MCU iteration of Reed Richards will be black, which is a very interesting way to go with the character. I like that they're changing up and not just being beholden to, you know, 60, 70-year-old comics.
Hey, hold on now. You weren't that down for it when it was about Magneto.
That's because Magneto is inherently a Jewish character, or else his hatred of mankind doesn't make sense without his persecution at the hands of the Nazis. Otherwise, you know, that makes him understandable of like, hey, I've been in this situation before and I know where it goes when they start rounding us up and labeling us. So I think that's where you can't change it without changing
the story.
Yeah, and ideologically who he is as a person.
Right, okay, that's fair.
I don't necessarily think that's the same thing with Reed Richards. Admittedly, not as, you know, knowledgeable as the Fantastic Four as I am about Magneto. But I think this fits in with kind of the hints and clues we have been getting. A lot of fans have theorized that the Fantastic Four are stuck in the quantum realm, which is why they won't, they will be explaining their absence throughout the whole MCU timeline.
Oh my God, I love that. I've never heard that.
Eagle-eyed viewers, this will, you'll like this even more. I'll send you the pictures. They saw in the Ant-Man and the Wasp scenes in the quantum zone, quantum realm, a city, or what looked like a city.
I saw that.
Right. So the theory is that they've been there. And so introducing Kang the Conqueror is essentially a stepping stone for reintroducing the MCU. And the rumors and whispers behind the scene in the industry is that Ant-Man 3 is supposed to be a bigger scale, bigger blockbuster than the previous two movies. So having Kang and the Fantastic Four certainly fits that bill.
You think that they're going to bring them in Ant-Man 3?
Perhaps not as a overarching like main plot line, but they'd have Kang. Kang's messing about. Kang, and then either in like one of the last few scenes or the post-credit scene, it's like, by the way, Kang is connected to this.
Right, okay. Yeah, so that's sick.
Yeah, and so the second thing I'm excited for as well, in some comic continuity, Nathaniel Richards is the founder of the Young Avengers before he turns into a villain. And we already know Disney is setting up a Young Avengers with Kate Bishop being introduced in the Hawkeye show, with Cassie Lang being set up to kind of take on that mantle eventually. With Miss Marvel will probably be on the team. So they're already in that Young Avengers mode, and putting out Kang, who founds it and is an enemy of it sometimes, just kind of brings everything full circle. So those are two potentially massive projects and overarching storylines across different mediums that are now tied to this one character. So the future of the MCU is, at least this corner, starting to take a little bit of shape.
Yeah, I mean, it's smart of them to lean young, you know? They haven't really done that, you know? They've tried to, you know, the one thing that the MCU has done well in the last few years, whether it be with Eternals or Shang-Chi, Black Panther. They've started to diversify their cast of heroes.
Good business. Don't forget about the moral obligations of representation. It literally is just good business. Everything you just mentioned is either a $1 billion blockbuster or is expected to make $1 billion.
Of course. So it's really twofold for them, because at the end of the day, these films are for kids. So now let's talk about who's playing Kang, because I feel like you know more about him than I do.
Yeah, so Jonathan Majors, young up-and-coming actor. His first leading role was The Last Black Man in San Francisco from last year, which was a really powerful film. And while he's a bit stoic as an actor, that is an intentional choice. It's not that he's a boring performer. He's not. His characters and his style is understated and subtle. And it's actually really, really effective. And for someone who's not exactly regal, but like Kang the Conqueror is a guy who's like, I'm not mincing my words. I don't get into play games. You know, I'm coming here to mess stuff up. That kind of understated power is actually really, really effective and fitting with this character. Now, more mainstream fans probably know him from Defy Bloods, which he plays Delroy Lindo's character's son in that, and Lovecraft Country, which is currently airing on HBO and HBO Max. This guy's on the come up big time.
Yeah,
he's
for
talented.
Sure.
For Lovecraft Country, he got that Marvel physique. You know, he was hitting the gym. So this is a very exciting hire in terms of like, wow, they're picking another talented person who hasn't quite popped yet.
Good for them. Because I had only seen him in Defy Bloods. That was the first time that I'd seen him. His role's not big, but just the fact that he's ripped off a Spike Lee film and then he leads his own HBO series and is now going to have a few film arc in the MCU, that is the definition of a come up.
Yeah, not to get too, you know, inside baseball, but that one scene in Defy Bloods where he's in the bar chatting up the German woman, that guy was just oozing like, I got movie star potential, like I got this.
Yeah. For sure.
That was cool. I'm excited about that. Now let's hop to a different studio, Warner Brothers, that finally, after months and months and months of speculation, finally dropped the first trailer of Dune.
An animal caught in a trap will gnaw off its own leg to escape. What will you do?
I know you.
One day, a legend will be born. All of civilization depends on it.
The future, I can see it. I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer.
I think the reason they waited so long is because they secretly know there's no chance Dune's coming in December, and it's probably going to be pushed into 2021. But that first trailer, man. Okay, we got Denis Villeneuve, and I apologize if I butchered that, which I probably did, who's one of the finest filmmakers in the game. We've got Timmy Chalamet, who's one of the best up-and-coming actors in the game. And we've got a whole host of other A-list, A1 awesome names. I'm really excited for this movie. And that first trailer increased my excitement tenfold. What about you?
The cast is as good of a cast as you'll see in any film.
Anchor is good.
Across any type, whether it's a drama, an MCU film, sci-fi, whatever. This is as good of a cast as you could possibly ask for. As for the text it's based on, have you read Dune? No, right?
I started Dune and had to stop after like three chapters because it was too much for me. And that's coming from the ultimate like nerd guy who like
it was too dense. You mean just too dense?
It was really dense. I didn't know what was going on. Having said that, I am going to give it a second chance at some point before the movie comes out. I've been planning on it, but you know, I had to put the book down, and that's saying something. I think.
Yeah. Okay. So I have not read the book, so I can't really speak to how good it looks in terms of it being Dune, but in terms of a sci-fi. It was like half Star Wars, half Mad Max vibes, kind of.
A little Game of Thrones sprinkled in with that political.
Yeah, drama. Yeah. So there's, and then as far as I'm concerned, Denis Villeneuve, or however the fuck you say it, he's probably a top five guy in the game right now. I mean, he pretty much doesn't miss. I don't think he's ever missed.
Even his most divisive English language film, which is Enemy with your boy Jake Gyllenhaal, even that, despite it being, you know, very kind of insular and weird, is entertaining and good in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I love that movie. It's fucking weird, and it's, I mean, the ending of that is, I still don't get it. But beyond that, so in terms of the pieces, it's got everything. The trailer brought a real sense of epicness and scope to it. The music, the set pieces. What's cool is that outside of, you know, a few clips of like hand-to-hand training and then the sandworm, you could tell that they didn't really show us much in terms of the big set pieces. So that's great. Do I think it's going to do well? And I know that this is something you really want to talk about. So I think the key here is to look at it from a point of view of, can you convince somebody who doesn't know what Dune is to go see it? Is the trailer enough to convince the average Joe to go see it? I would say yes. Not in today's world, though, because as we could see, I would say that
emoji.
Tenet is probably a bigger draw. Chris Nolan has more of a brand name. And based on the way that that's going, that doesn't give me much hope for anything to be released until there's a cure. So I also hope that they smartly just wait, which would suck for us because we both know that this looks fucking fantastic. I would love to see it as soon as possible. But if they want it to not be an abject failure, sort of like Blade Runner, then they have to wait.
Yeah, so what Warner Brothers wants with this is for it to be a two-film series that, you know, splitting the book up into two films and support an HBO Max spinoff, which is already in development. Now, having said that, those are ambitious goals for a very, very dense, niche sci-fi property, a trailer that looks great to you and me, but absolutely is esoteric, and the average moviegoer would be like, I have no idea what's going on, and I don't care. And on top of all that, filmmaking, the marketplace, it simply has just changed. New to screen concepts do not work anymore. The Hunger Games was the last mega box new to screen franchise, and perhaps the last one we'll ever see. Just in the last 10 years, these are the ones I could remember off the top of my head without even doing a deep dive. These were new to screen, would-be franchise launchers that absolutely just bombed horrifically. Green Lantern, The Lone Ranger, Assassin's Creed, Warcraft, The Dark Tower, Mortal Engines, A Wrinkle in Time, Jupiter Ascending, Valerian and a City of Thousand Planets. So that's nine off the top of my head. I know, technically speaking, Dune isn't a new-to-screen property because in 1984, David Lynch did his own version, which bombed horrifically. But given that that was, you know, basically 40 years ago, and that outside of sci-fi novel fans, Dune is not exactly a Harry Potter, this is, for all intents and purposes, a new-to-screen concept. And it just doesn't seem viable in this marketplace. Do I hope I'm wrong in that the spectacle and the timing and the cast bring in just hordes of audiences? Absolutely. Do I think I'm going to be wrong? No, I feel very confident this movie's going to make like 280 million worldwide to fail to break even, and we're going to love it. And the average moviegoer is like, that was boring.
That's low. That's a low total. I mean, it says right, let me see if I can find it.
I just took that one out of my ass. But the point still stands.
Well, let me see if I could find their budget real quick.
I don't think there's any budget information out there yet, but obviously, I mean, they filmed in Jordan. They did a lot of on-location stuff. There's clearly a lot of effects.
Yeah, you got to
form is like got to be like $10 million worth of, you know, CGI right there.
Well, so let's see. 2049 cost them. Wow. So 2049 only made $260 million. So you're saying that this
is directed by Denis Villeneuve.
Yeah. And that's a bigger name, I think, than Dune, probably.
Yeah, listen, I was pulling that 280 million figure out of my head.
No, I know. So 2049 cost them anywhere from $150 million to $185 million. You got to think Dune is more than that. It's a bigger scale movie. So you're looking at a price tag of around 200 million, probably. Woo! That doesn't smell good. Yeah, that's not good.
The problem, too, with COVID and that fact that Wonder Woman just moved to December is that that probably pushes Dune back. And the holiday season is the single best movie-going stretch in the entire calendar year. It is a huge, basically, summer blockbuster play with higher upside because families are off work and they're all going together. It is the reason why Star Wars movies have done so well in recent years. It's the reason why Aquaman put up more than 300 million domestic despite being a turd. Sorry, DCEU fans, but check out our podcast on Aquaman because then you can hear us really expand on it. So the fact that it's probably going to move into 2021 where there's no real clear release date for it, it's just all bad signs, man, bad omens for what otherwise looks like a really cool movie.
They're going to obviously hope that word of mouth carries it forward. Just hearing that, oh, it's a sci-fi, because you got to think that most of the target demo, which is what, the 16 to 45-year-old male, like sci-fi, right? I think most men like sci-fi. So if there's A, you see that stack cast, and B, you hear it's great, that may be enough to get people to go. But it has to have good word of mouth and great reviews. Because if it's like a 70% score, that's not good enough. It's got to be in the 90s. It's got to be blowing people's mind. And then maybe it has a chance.
But that's the problem, because as soon as Blade Runner 2049 came out, almost universally, everyone's like, yep, that's a masterpiece. And just nothing.
Yeah. But that's not sort of the big sci-fi scale. That starred two big names. This is sort of a franchise, a would-be, like, they're going to sell this as a franchise. It is a larger cast. I mean, you see that.
Said Blade Runner 2049 was the most expensive art house film he's ever. And he has said here that that's not the approach he's taking.
I mean, the fact that that got made, really, if you think about it, is a miracle. I mean, it's in my top 10 films of all time. I love that movie. That's why I'm excited for Dune for that very reason. But yeah, a lot needs to go right, and there's a very, very fine gap for it to go right through, and I don't see it happening as things stand. If they push it back to, you know, a full year even, which would suck, but that would probably be for the best of the film, and it's great, which I think it will be. I think it has a chance. I'd say right now there's a, if we assume it's great, and what a success would be if it doubled its total, so $500 million worldwide.
So yeah, it's, I think at that level, and given what they want from it in the future, gotta be $500 million.
So I think as things currently stand, if they don't, if they push back the date and if it's great, they have a good shot at that. But if not, it won't even come close.
All right, so there's a lot of unknowns with Dune. We have our fingers crossed. We're hoping for the best. But the simple fact is nobody knows anything right now in this marketplace. No one knows anything with these types of new concepts. So we're going to just muscle on that for a little bit, take a little break. Then we're going to come back. We're going to dive into The Dark Knight. I've never, ever run into anyone who wasn't down for a conversation to The Dark Knight and didn't enjoy listening to one. So I know all you guys out there are going to have some fun with this. And we're back with the post-credit pod. We are finally, I think Eric has really just started this podcast with me secretly so he could just build up to a pod dedicated entirely to The Dark Knight. Like, he didn't care about our first couple ones. He doesn't care about, you know, texting me for the schedules and everything. He just wants to talk about The Dark Knight.
It's part of the plan, Brandon.
I'm glad you said that, because that plays into a question we're going to have later in this conversation. But to start, Eric, one thing I absolutely love about The Dark Knight is that it works just as well as a straight up action crime genre as it does a comic book film. It's, I think personally, it's reminiscent of Heat in terms of this kind of conversational tension and pulse pounding practical stunt work. All the comic book films that came before, you know, you got your Spider-Mans, you got your X-Mans, all that, they all felt like comic book movies. Now that is not inherently a bad thing. That's fine. There were a lot of great ones, but The Dark Knight feels like hard-boiled naturalism mixed with summer blockbuster proportions. You can see it as a response to the Iraq war. You can see it as meditation on domestic terrorism. There's a case to be made that it's the smartest blockbuster since The Matrix, which you and I have talked a lot about in our superhero movie draft podcast, which people should check out. So I think versatility, first and foremost, is what stands out to me about The Dark Knight.
Did you know that this film only has a 94% score on Rotten Tomatoes?
I would love to interview the 6% and ask them who hurt them in childhood.
What is wrong with people? I just
opinions are fine, but like, come on.
Yeah, like you're just trying too hard, man. So I think you brought up a great point with Heat. It's almost become a cliche to be like, this is not a comic book film. This is a crime drama that stars Batman. But it's true. That's the best way to really... I love these films, but one of the things that I look forward towards the Batman for is that it's going to be grounded and gritty, but it's going to be more comic booky. The Dark Knight has no sense of comic bookness whatsoever. It is a completely crystal clear take on, if Batman were to exist in our world, the world that we live in right now, what would that world be like?
Nolan seems like he detests comic books based on this trilogy. I'm not saying that is a bad thing. He very much wanted to scrub all comic bookness out of this trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is the, you know, and we've talked about this on this pod before, how like the grounded and gritty take on films has become sort of a retired phrase. You hear that all the time, but there is a reason that this movie stands as the perfect use of that. It's probably one of the best films of my lifetime, I think, pound for pound, in terms of what it's done. It redefined comic book films, as you just said, like what came before felt inherently comic booky, whereas this literally changed the Academy Awards to expand their field, which is changed film as we know it, because now movies like Parasite can not just get in there, but could win.
It is funny because The Dark Knight ruled the Oscars when they expanded it to up to 10 candidates was meant to include more commercial fare. And it actually had the reverse effect, where smaller, more indie pictures like a Moonlight, like a Parasite were getting in. And it's funny that it had the reverse effect, but we also got treated to much better cinema in that race because of it.
And then we could just, and we will go on in Heath about Heath Ledger. But when I rewatched this, and I've probably watched this, if I had to guess, in my life.
Realistically.
Seriously. If I had to guess, upwards of 50 times.
That seems about right.
It transcends acting. He, and I think a lot of it has to do with because the fact that he passed, but it doesn't feel like a performance. It feels real. I think the Dark Knight's greatest strength is how real it feels. And that's because of him. He's this war-painted nut job that is almost a being unto himself. He does, like, it seems like they hired the Joker to play the Joker.
Which is something the Joker would do if he existed. Nobody can play me except me. Action.
Exactly. So I think that it has three things that have impacted film as we know it since it came out. The way films are awarded, the way that comic book films are seen, and the performance that it contains is one of the definitive acting portrayals of the last 30 years or so.
I'd actually add a fourth criteria to that as well. It elevated the superhero genre, of course, by taking it much more seriously. It was also only the fourth film ever to cross $1 billion at the worldwide box office. In the 12 years since, more than 40 films have done so. It was the number two domestic grosser ever after its theatrical run. And it was the first comic book movie to cross $1 billion worldwide. Just a few short later, everyone was up in arms because, you know, Man of Steel and BVS failed to do so. So the fact that it set the financial benchmark for the rest of the industry is just another kind of feather in the cap of how many, I don't know.
It set tons of benchmarks that now serve as a standard for the way that we know film. Films like this are now assumed. If you don't make $1 billion, especially with these names, it's a failure.
And that's probably a bad reductive way of thinking. But the fact that this is now the metric of success speaks to how influential it was on multiple levels. But I'm glad that you mentioned Heath, because Heath Ledger, probably almost as much as Christopher Nolan in a way, validated the legitimacy of comic book movies in the mid-2000s, you know? He helped inflate the bubble to what it eventually became. And I think there's a through line, and I'm not the first person to point this out, between Alan Rickman's Hans Gruber, Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter, and Heath Ledger's Joker. Iconic scene-stealing villains. And it really wasn't until The Dark Knight that I realized it isn't just their charisma and the acting that kind of make us fall in love with these evil antagonists. It's that they are completely free of inhibitions and like societal shackles. And while hopefully most of us aren't secretly, you know, sociopathic killers underneath, I can't speak to what's going on with you, Eric, but I don't feel that I'm that way. We do probably all yearn at one point or another for a similar sense of freedom that these characters seem to embody. So even though they're evil, we kind of want to be a little bit like them. And I think Heath Ledger straddled that line really well. He's clearly a nut job. But Joker is someone that does not care about what anybody thinks. And there's a liberation in that.
So you put it down to the fact that we sort of want to be them, where I think it boils down to the fact that we can be. I think that villains are inherently more relatable to us because being a hero, whether that be, you know, just your standard film leading man, just the way that they look, act, money, talent, all that stuff, or being a comic book flying around hero, we can't relate to that as much as we can being the bad guy. You know, the Joker himself points it out in The Killing Joke, which it had a huge influence on this film. All it takes is one bad day for us to become like him. Batman, I don't have $5 billion. I can't just become that, but I could paint my face white and go outside and raise hell right now if I really wanted to. So in the same sense that we saw the rise of the anti-hero on TV with Sopranos and The Wire and Breaking Bad, it's the same thing, sort of. Being the golden boy is not something that you could really relate to as much as being a guy whose life just went to shit, and now this is who you are.
Eric, I'd follow you if you went out and became an anarchist cult leader. I think that'd be fun.
See, the problem is that I would not last as long as he lasted. I feel like I'd get caught in 2 hours. So I'm impressed as well.
Yeah, I mean, that guy knew his way around a scheme or two, you know? That guy was plotting.
Yeah, so just to put a bow on it, I think in the same sense that we could feel like we could be them, I also think that they're more nuanced and more complex, because whereas the good guy is the good guy, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Batman's not gonna kill in most takes
as much as Joker wants him to,
you know, he is always gonna have his moral code, whereas Joker, you sort of get his point. It's not as black and white, it's more gray area, and that's what being a man is. It's more gray than it is black and white. So I think that it sort of plays into just being who we are as people. The bad guys are more on our level.
I think in terms of relatability and characterization, you're absolutely right, especially when it comes to the Dark Knight trilogy, which I believe, and I've talked about it on this pod before, Batman Begins is actually the only movie in this trilogy about Bruce Wayne and Batman, which is why it's one of my favorites of all time. I think his character development in that film is just phenomenal and works on so many levels. The next two movies are more so about the villains in many good ways. And I'm not saying it's like he abandoned the focus on Bruce Wayne, but I would say those movies more so thematically and philosophically belong to our antagonist. So I would like to ask you, before we move into our awards and categories, do you think Christian Bale is a better Batman or Bruce Wayne? Because we get varying degrees of both throughout these three films.
I've long said that Bruce Wayne are in these films more than Batman is. So you have to be just as good as a Bruce Wayne as you are Batman. Now, for as good as the Dark Knights, you know, the three films are, I think that because of how realistic it's played, it's not as Batman-y as we want to see him.
I agree completely.
So in that sense, I'm not crazy about the Batman itself in these films. It's fine, it's good, but in terms of how I want my Batman to be, I think what we've seen with Ben Affleck is more towards that. Now, that said, he is a great Bruce Wayne.
Really, really
good. Every, whether it's like playing the dumb rich guy or playing the cocky rich guy or playing the douchebag rich guy, or when he's in his private scenes with Alfred showing who he really is.
Those are my favorite Bruce Wayne moments in the whole franchise. Him and Alfred one-on-one conversations.
Yeah. You know, when he, you know, it's rare that you hear Bruce ask, like, what would you have me do? Those scenes are his strongest scenes. And that's what Bale brings to the role. That is where he makes it something more. So if I had to pick one, I would say his Bruce Wayne is probably the best, but not his Batman. And then there's the voice, of course, which is a huge problem.
I don't know if it's a generational thing, which it ultimately might be. You know, like our kids may be like, no, my Batman's the best. But the reason why I prefer Christian Bale to Michael Keaton, who I love, is that I just think the script affords that Bruce Wayne a little bit more vulnerability. Whereas, you know, Michael Keaton's Batman is a straight up nut, which I love. It's great. But I don't think we get those shades of sympathy as we do with Bruce Wayne, who we really go on that origin journey with, which helps to establish the why and the understanding.
You know, one of the quotes from the Dark Knight that has remained part of the culture the most is from one of those one-on-one scenes. The "some men just want to watch the world burn" quote is probably the most quotable line from this film.
And it's a lot of quotable lines.
Which speaks to how powerful this one was. Just goes to show that it wasn't a Batman scene, not a Joker scene. It was a Bruce Wayne scene that stuck.
Yeah, I think that's where we're pretty much in lock and step. The fact is, Christian Bale's Bruce Wayne was awesome. I like his Batman more than you, but I do agree that maybe kinetically, physically, you know, seeing it in motion, perhaps the Ben Affleck kind of fluidity Batman was a bit more imposing and impressive. But ultimately, I mean, you know, I'm giving this guy like an A- overall. maybe in a straight up.
Oh, bag. For sure. For sure. No doubt. I mean, this is a nitpick of nitpicking.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think more of that falls on the world of the films than Bale himself. Batman just simply can't be the sort of more comic book version that I would like to see in this world. So
both his villains are just instant meme classics.
Right, and that too.
All right, well, that's a perfect segue into our awards and categories. We're just going to run through some of the notable moments of this film. First up, the best hero moment. Eric, is there a single scene, line, part of the movie where you're like, damn, that guy is the man?
I think this one was low-key hard because it's a film that's owned by the villain. The bad guy is who you root for and whose scenes you wait to see. So with that said, I think the only choice here is the ending.
He didn't do anything wrong.
Because he's the hero Gotham deserves, but not the one it needs right now. So we'll hunt him. Because he can take it. Because he's not our hero. He's a silent guardian, a watchful protector, a dark knight.
Because, right? Is that yours as well? Or?
Me too.
Yeah, so the ending, I mean, the speech is A1. Nolan loves to end his films with that sort of epic speech overlaying a sort of mic drop, all right? And in this, with Batman driving off up and into the light, which are two thematic wink and nods, with voiceover, and then within the context of what he's doing, like taking the fall, because what they need right now is a very powerful theme that I think hits home, especially in the case of Batman, who is inherently, you know, when it comes to guys like Iron Man or Captain America or Superman, they're more just inherently good. Like, nobody doubts that these guys are normal, you know, to some extent they're bachelors. Batman is sort of seen as like this myth or a freak, even. Some people don't even know if he's a real man. So when you take all that into context, on top of how well Christian Bale plays Bruce Wayne and knowing the toll of how truly and deeply he wants to do good and how he's willing to put that want aside for the better of Gotham, slaps. That is Batman. That is Batman. In a film that's dominated by the bad guy, I think the ending does a great job of bringing home how much Batman really does give up to do what he does.
I agree completely. I love the ending for its thematic potency. As Bruce Wayne himself says in Batman Begins, that as a man, he can be corrupted, he can be killed, and ultimately he can be defeated. As a symbol, he can become far more. At the end of The Dark Knight, he does become a symbol, but it's inverted and kind of mutilated from what we initially thought it might be when he set out. And there's this tragic beauty to it, because now he is a symbol for evil, for someone who has disregarded the law, who has taken it into his own hands, and has taken life. And that is a symbol that Gotham rallies around, because Gordon realizes he needs to blame Batman for the murders. He knows that society needs to push their fears and concerns onto something to unite them, and also push their hopes onto something to unite them as well. It's this, to stick with kind of the two-faced metaphor, it is two sides of the same coin that ultimately allow this society to prevent itself from collapsing in on itself, because they are united against a common foe and they need to believe in the incorruptibility of good and the kind of standalone remoteness and isolation of evil. And by sacrificing his name, his dream, his goals, he fulfills that need and that hole in this Gotham City that is so plagued and so burdened. And that, like Gordon said, that's the hero that the people need and deserve, whatever, whichever one he closes off on. That's a beautiful thing that is thematically rich, that is a compelling narrative turn that sets up the second film and just really hits home to start off, to end.
He corrupts his own life's work, a life's work that was built out of a horrible life-changing loss of his mom and dad, in order to fulfill that very life goal. It is like almost a chicken and egg of what Batman wants to be. He has to give up the life work so his life's work can succeed. I mean, it's brilliant on every level. I do think it sets up, as you said, the third film in an awesome way. I think part of it, we're not going to talk about The Dark Knight Rises much on this pod, probably. I do think the way that they bring him back is probably the strongest part of that film in terms of like the spreading of the hope that he could come back.
Just honestly, for a quick sidetrack, imagine being like a Gotham City resident and like 8 years go by, haven't seen this urban legend for so long, and then just all of a sudden he's on the highway on his motorcycle being like, what's up, guys? Yeah. Like, that is like LeBron taking a hiatus and like coming back game seven and be like, yo, I got it, don't worry.
I thought that was cool. I thought that was cool.
Now that kind of pairs nicely with the second one, which is the real MVP award. Now, if you don't mind, Eric, I would like to go first on this one because my answer is a little non-traditional.
Please, by all means.
I would like to go and give it to Nolan, but more specifically, the stunt designer, because that truck flip with the Joker popularized that move in blockbusters. Now, admittedly, Terminator 2 and Terminator 3 did have some cool truck flips, but those weren't all practical. This, he literally flipped a truck. Just from a technical, logistical, practical standpoint, that is so damn impressive. And then every blockbuster after tried to copy it. You saw truck flips in Transformers, Fast and Furious, a couple others that I wrote down, but of course can't find on my huge page of notes right now. Everyone wanted in on it, and Nolan and his stunt team engineered his own subset of niche fads in Hollywood while also creating this huge, you know, as we said, overarching fad about kind of gritty, realistic blockbusters. And I think that is so cool to have one moment in your film endure in that way and that kind of be a copycat for the rest of blockbusters for a few years.
Great shout, because that stunt has aged fantastically, where in that same sort of set piece where Joker takes down the chopper with those lines, cables, that CG has not aged well.
Yeah, really good point. It's a good juxtaposition within, you know, 20 seconds of each other or something like that.
Yep. So I think, I mean, that scene, it is so cool. That sort of leans into one of mine, the Batpod.
Batpod.
But, and that's just a quick one, because I have, of course, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 here.
Of course you do.
Batpod is one because it just looks so dope. Batman looks sick on it when he's weaving through traffic and people, and he does that sort of wall turn thing, and awesome. Turning your head, gotta have it. Yeah, it's nice. The fact that they finally addressed the fact that Batman cannot turn his head and figured out a way to work that into the plot itself. The same way that we like the way that Zack Snyder dealt with the voice thing, this was a great way to deal with the head turning.
Eric, I don't know if you've ever been in a fight, but turning your head helps.
Yes, indeed. Bullets and gasoline. It's all it took. It's all I needed.
Couple of dynamite.
Joker's laugh. He fucking nailed it, dude. The scene where he's getting his ass kicked by Batman and he's cracking up. Amazing. It's so good. And then the obvious choice is Heath, but we're going to talk about him later. So I guess I've got to go Nolan here, because as we've just said, you know, he brought comic book film, not just comic book film, but action drama, which is probably the most successful genre, I guess you could say, sort of. Like, now comic book films took that place, but at their core, they are an action drama.
And just to build off that for a second, a deep dive into the correlation between Rotten Tomatoes scores and box office. This is a recent one from just a couple weeks ago, found that the most forgiving genre was the action kind of blockbuster drama, which you could have a crappy Rotten Tomatoes score and still make beaucoup bucks.
Yep, exactly. So, but he brought that to new heights. I mean, this is thought of, as I just said, one of the best films of the last 30 years or so. And that's all because of him. When it comes down to it, as much as I think that there's, you know, I talk about this every time, his fight scenes are not great. And when it comes to the Batman that I want to see, the number one thing that I want to see him doing is kick ass. And those scenes in these three films aren't that great. But not only did this put comic book films on the map, it put him on the map, where in a sense was like, all right, this guy is the guy now. He can do whatever he wants from this point forth.
That was his carte blanche moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nolan. It's like, you know, I think The Prestige is probably my favorite Nolan film overall. And hopefully we have decades and decades of more Nolan films to come. But, you know, this is the one he's remembered for.
For sure. As you once said, this is the one that'll be on his grave.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Now, this next question, I'm pretty sure everyone on Earth has the same answer to it. Is there a villain that could have made this movie better?
Yeah, that's just a fat no. We just don't need to spend much time on this one. No.
And for those who don't know, Nolan planned to bring the Joker back for the third movie, which I think is everything you need to know about his plans, his appreciation, Heath's performance, everything. Yeah, so, no.
One can only hope. I was going to save this one for the end, but there was a time where Leo was linked to playing the Riddler in the third one, which would have just been, you know, outrageous.
Was that like one of those real rumors or fake rumors?
No, so I wrote about it for our site. I could pull it up. I think it was said by either a screenwriter or someone attached to the film is the one who said it.
So it had a little bit more merit than your average. We got this covered.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Okay, that's cool. Of course I would have liked to see that.
Yeah. And so the plan, I mean, and again, this was before Heath had passed, or so that would have been unreal. But in terms of this film, no, of course not.
Right. Okay.
Of course not. This is, as I said at the top, this is the villain. This is probably one of the most iconic performances pound for pound of my lifetime.
Now, this is my favorite award of the whole shebangabang. And man, every episode that we use it, I just get excited. The Jared Leto Award for the film's worst performance, hard to find in this movie, because there's really not anyone that is like blatantly bringing down the ship at all.
I've got one.
Hit me.
The guy who yells, "No more dead cops."
I wrote down, and I can take a screenshot for you, Eric will pick the no dead cops gun. I swear to God. I swear to God I knew you were going to
say that. I believe you. That's amazing. He's terrible.
I'm so glad that I know you that well.
Yeah, well, because I've said it before. He cracks me up. He's going for it. That guy went for it.
My only counter to that was, I think that's maybe a worse line of dialogue than it is a worse delivery of that line.
I don't know, man. I don't. It's both, but all right. I could see your point, but no chance.
That's fair. So I couldn't go with a worst acting performance. So instead, I'm
choosing... Gyllenhaal is not great as well. I don't love her because I find that...
So who was it? I missed that.
Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't help her case that she was in a recast role. So it sort of jars you out of the continuity. But she just felt inherently cold, I guess, whereas Katie Holmes has this girl next door childhood crushness to her that I bought in the first film. In this film, she never seemed like she cared about Bruce Wayne enough that being with him was ever a choice for her at all. Like, she feels like the vibe that I get off her is like the fact that Bruce can't pick up on those vibes when I pick up on those vibes is a problem. She doesn't seem like she was ever in love with him at any point.
I just, again, I feel like that is the result of an underwritten character. Because personally, I think Maggie Gyllenhaal acts circles around Katie Holmes in everything, their whole
right, career. Exactly. She's a better actress, but in terms of, like, she's pretty much just playing Bruce Wayne's love. And that's not, like, as you just said, she's underwritten, but it's a Batman movie. Like, come on. What are we talking about here, you know?
Make her Catwoman. No, so I didn't go with an acting performance per se. I went with the worst performance of a character within this actual universe. And that goes to the goon who steps up to the Joker only to get a fucking pencil through the eye.
And I thought my jokes were bad.
Give me one reason why I shouldn't have my boy here pull your head off.
How about a magic trick? I'm gonna make this pencil disappear. Ta-da! It's gone. Oh, and by the way, the suit, it wasn't cheap. You ought to know, you bought it.
Oh, great call.
That guy had 5 seconds of screen time, that character, and just immediately lost. Like, it's comparable to haters talking trash to Lamar Jackson last season before he just went off on the entire league. It is so, in retrospect, hilarious that this guy stands up, takes 3 steps, and is dead. That's his whole purpose in the film.
In the most extremely brutal way to go as well.
Pencil in the eye. Not a way I want to go.
Death via eyeball brain.
I mean,
first you lose your eyeball, and then and that's his first scene, right? So that's such a great way to show that he's not just some nut job. He's got some serious hand-to-hand skill as well.
Well, he's got the opening scene with the bank robbery. That's not the hand-to-hand skill, but like that immediately establishes.
Yeah, but he only has one line in that scene. In terms of when you're introduced to the Joker, like, this is our new Joker. It's that scene.
Yeah. All right. So let's switch from the negative performance to the positive. The Jim Gordon Award for Best Performance from a Non-Superhero. Now, we have said throughout this whole pod that Heath Ledger is just going to pop up all the time, and I'm going with Heath Ledger here. I mean, you cannot talk about performances in this movie without starting and stopping the conversation with Heath Ledger. He's not the superhero. He's not the main guy, which is why it counts. And you just don't talk about The Dark Knight and performances without first and foremost talking about Heath Ledger. He's so
Brandon,
good.
The award is named after Jim Gordon. His namesake is in the award.
So you're going to give it to Jim Gordon, Gary Oldman, over Heath Ledger?
Heath gets his own award.
Now, Heath gets all the awards to me.
Oh, I like that. I respect that, but...
And I like Gary Oldman, but, like, you know, there's more guy acting in this.
Yeah,
movie.
But I think you definitely bent the rules on this one to sneak in a crafty pick. And I do like that point. But the fact is, this was named after sort of a guy that's not one of the A-listers. Like, he's not the top tier guy in the film who's got powers or sway on the plot, really. He's sort of like the right hand man, and it's named after Jim Gordon because this guy is the only one in the GCPD who's like, maybe we should work with the nut job and the bat and have him help us. Like, I will never understand how more cops aren't on that wave. If I had a bat out there at night cleaning up streets, breaking a couple laws, but none really very bad laws, you know, again, if he starts to drive his car through, like, buildings and shit, that's a different story. But beyond that, he's the only cop who's like, yo, we should loop this guy in. So yeah, it's him. And it's played by an Academy Award winner who's pretty much in the third role. Or no, sorry, fourth role even. The fourth field role.
He takes his own death and doesn't tell his wife in the movie, which is a bold move. And then in real life, a few years ago, I believe it was a Saudi journalist who did the same thing in real life to expose some type of conspiracy and didn't tell his wife. Like, I wish I had looked it up before we started talking. That was dumb of me not to remember. But I remember reading the real news story and be like, oh my God, he's Jim Gordon. Oh my God.
That just shows how committed he is to his job.
the guy's not messing around when it comes to protecting
the government. He took a bullet in the back, lied to his wife and child, and let them think he was dead because he's committed to the game. And that's why he's the only choice here.
Except he's not. And the next award proves it too, because it is introducing for the very first time, and we'll keep this in the rotation for future pods, the Heath Ledger Award for Movie Stealing Performance. I'm going to go with Heath Ledger. What do you think?
Same. And this whole pod has pretty much been about him so far, really.
Warranted, though.
Yes, because as I said, it is the only time. And I think the fact that, again, he passed plays a lot into this, but I just see a living, breathing character, and that's very rare. The one guy who does that pretty much every time he's on screen is Daniel Day-Lewis, and Heath is in that class here, where it's just, he is gone. You can't even tell it's him beneath what's really just face paint, which is astounding.
And you remember the online backlash that erupted after he was initially cast.
Yep.
Boy, did we not know what was coming.
And, you know, he won the first comic book Oscar, which is huge. I don't think there's been one.
Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah. So the Joker.
Same role.
Yeah. So he just brought comic book acting. If this film doesn't have him, and if Joker's not a home run, like, I forget who else was in talks for the role at the time, but I think it was like they thought about, like, Jack wanted to come back. I think the name Adrian Brody was out there at the time, Robin Williams. So there were some wild names. If this role is not as good as it is, there's no way that we look at The Dark Knight as sort of one of the all-time greats. There's just no chance. He carries this to an extent that no comic book film has been carried by someone whose name is not in the film's title.
He elevates literally every scene he's in.
You're waiting for his scenes. His scenes are the one that you can't wait to see. You're on the edge of your seat every time, hanging on every single word.
Okay, so speaking of his scenes, do you have one particular scene or quote from the Joker in The Dark Knight that is your absolute favorite?
So you said in a text as a joke, all of them. And that's kind of facts, really. It's tough to pick one. So I think if I had to choose not just a whole scene, but one line, it would be where he says of us, and us just being normal people, they're only as good as the world allows them to be. And I think that that is so haunting. His whole idea boiled down to that one quote. He's like, that pretty much this is all a fugazi act, and that when stripped down and when let off our leash, we're savages. And I think that's powerful, because especially in the world that we live in now, we see that every day. We see people choose violence and hate and chaos every single day. So the fact that he sort of boiled that down in a way that portrays the fact that he's like, you think I'm bad? They're all like me. You know, it's just a home run.
You can't go wrong with any of his scenes in terms of his vocalization about his anarchistic philosophies, because they are so richly woven and so well delivered that they are all excellent. But I'm going in a different direction, and I think by the end of this very quick story, you'll understand why. In college, I was in a fraternity, and in that fraternity, we drank a lot of alcohol. And when you're in a fraternity with a bunch of dudes drinking alcohol, testosterone levels can get pretty high and tensions and conflicts can occur. So there's this one time my buddy and my other buddy are arguing vehemently about some BS or other, when all of a sudden it escalates from argument to full-blown fisticuffs. I'm like, oh my God, I turned to my friend. I'm like, should we break it up? And he just looks at me and goes, it's all part of the plan, Kath. And I just started dying laughing as my two friends are still beating each other up. And I'm on the floor just doubled over, because I wasn't expecting him to just go, hey, it's all part of the plan. I'm the Joker, like in the middle of a serious situation.
Chaos, baby.
Yeah, exactly. So that forever has been ingrained in my brain, is just hilarious, applicable, usable, wonderful line. And thankfully, there was no major injuries in that fight, because at the end of the day, they were both soft. So we really avoided anything truly bad, and I got a great laugh out of it.
Plus, that line is one of the more quoted lines. Like, you could use that gif or you could use that line in a lot of context to this day. Like, that's still a line that I say a lot, that you say a lot. And it's been 13 years, or no, sorry, 12 years. That's a long ass time.
Exactly. So I like that you went with the kind of philosophical answer. I went with the dumb, funny one.
Yep. Which is a change of roles on this podcast.
Look at that, man. We're so chameleonic. All right. So this is a movie that it's not like a brain buster, like some of Nolan's other films that demand multiple rewatches to understand. It demands multiple rewatches because there's so much good content. But is there one thing in particular when you're watching, like, oh, wait, rewind that real quick. Which moment would you give that award to? So fans understand, what is the number one thing they got to maybe absorb a couple times before they get it?
I mean, come on. There's only one right choice here, right?
My answer is probably going to differ from yours.
Oh, you are a piece of work. You know that?
Slippery, baby.
So it's his one-on-one with Batman. I mean, there's just no question. The rant that he goes on, the one that I just said is part of my best line, the rant that he goes on where he explains his view of people, and he's not like, you know, a lot of the times he speaks during this film, he's sort of joking around, like he's telling a lie about his scars, or he's sort of, dropping jokes. That is gone in this scene. He is being straight up man-to-man, one-on-one. He's like, this is my worldview. Here's why yours is fucking stupid. and I'm going to prove it to you. And he does.
To them, you're just a freak. Like me. They need you right now. But when they don't, they'll cast you out. Like a leper. You see, their morals, their code. It's a bad joke. I'm dropped at the first sign of trouble. They're only as good as the world allows them to be. I'll show you. When the chips are down, these civilized people, they'll eat each other. See, I'm not a monster. I'm just ahead of the curve.
Well, he doesn't necessarily, because ultimately the citizens of Gotham don't blow each other up.
Yeah, but he still gets Dent.
Which is going to lead into my answer.
Okay, so so the point being is, as you like to say that this film will be on Nolan's grave, this to me is like when you point out the Joker scene, the moment, this is it.
Now I'm just thinking about, in typical Nolan twisty fashion, his epitaph reads, it's all part of the plan. And then his coffin pops open and there's no body. Ah, twist! But so to your point, the citizens of Gotham don't succumb, but he does succeed in turning Harvey Dent. I would say pound for pound, you know, the average moviegoer would probably say the Harvey Dent storyline is probably the weakest of the main kind of ABC plots, because we're just so enamored with everything going on with the Joker. But in rewatching it for this pod, I gained, I think, a newfound respect, because Dent is so representative of this movie's best thematic qualities. He is referred to throughout the movie as Gotham's White Knight, and his line about heroes and villains foreshadows his eventual transformation and the kind of the arc of Batman in Gotham. But The Dark Knight, that title, can also actually be a reference to him, the once pure and incorruptible force of good in Gotham that has been mutilated and co-opted by the Joker. It's tragic, and it's handled so effectively throughout the film. It highlights, like what you said before, that our morality and our capacity for good exist only within the context of the coin flip of fate. He's a symbol, much like what we've discussed with Batman, and he's also an audience surrogate. We are all capable of that duality that lurks within us, good and evil. And he personifies everything the Joker espouses throughout the whole film, and everything that we hope about ourselves and fear about ourselves. And so in rewatching it again for the 20th or some odd time, I always liked his storylines, but this time really paying attention, I was like, wow, this is kind of the script's backbone right here. and this is what it's all about. And so rewind that real quick, all of Harvey Dent's moments.
Wow. So great pick. And Dent is sort of a personification of Joker's idea that it takes one bad day. That theme is manifested through Dent. He has one bad day, and he goes from being the savior of a town that hadn't had one in decades to being a bad guy, just like Joker. I've always found the complaints about Cart and Dent's story to be odd. I think that it's only because we're so obsessed with Ledger's Joker that we don't give Dent's performance is great, you know?
Aaron Eckhart's good in it, man.
You would have thought that his career was going to kick on from then, but it did the opposite. His career went down from there, which is stunning because he's got that smugness to him at the start, which is a key to Dent. That's what you want. And then despite the fact that he's turned, you know, the way that he's views the world and who he is. And
not like Batman turning left to right.
Right, that too. The fact that he is now this half-burnt freak, you still sympathize with him like crazy. As we talked about at the top, we could relate to villains more. I get why he's pissed off at Batman and Gordon and the cops. He points out that he feels scorned. He feels like he paid the price for trying to do the right thing. He says, we were trying to be decent men in an indecent time. And what he's saying there is he regrets. And how many times in life have you done the right thing and gotten screwed for it? That's something we could all relate to. And him paying the ultimate price, not just losing the love of his life, but his own humanity.
Because
his fucking face. Yeah. Because he tried to do the right thing and portraying that, he's saying, you guys haven't lost anything. I've lost everything. Powerful. He's great in this. You could almost make a case that he got snubbed, that Heath should have been up for best actor and that he should have snuck in here at best supporting, because I do think he's that good in this.
I need a list of the nominations that year in front of me to make a judgment on that. But yeah, I do think it's an underrated element of the movie.
Well, just with no
context. I don't know if I'm going to nominate him for that, although I think he did a good job. Now, this whole podcast has essentially been a love fest about The Dark Knight. Understandably so. It's a pretty good movie. If you haven't seen it, you should probably check it out. But let's seriously put on our critic caps and try to dig into this. What is the worst thing you can say about The Dark Knight? And this is gun to your head. You got to choose something.
Yeah,
not so, too perfect. Or like, you know, in a job interview, I care too much. I
think. Yeah, right. So a small one here is that I like the Batman Begins suit more. I just think he looks more imposing and scary and more, and it's blacker. It's more Batman-y to me. Tiny thing. You've pointed out before how the third act stacks climax on climax. It is the last...
What's going on?
I did a count. The last hour and a half, I was going to bring this up at the end, but I'll say it now. It goes from the chase in the streets where they're trying to get Dent to jail, to the one-on-one between Batman and Joker, to Rachel's death, to Joker's escape, to exploding the hospital, to the Two-Face reveal, to the Joker showdown in that tower, to then the three-way face-off at the end. This is an hour and a half straight of film-ending type moments. But of those, the biggest of them all, the big building raid set piece where he's using sort of this sonar tech, is Nolan at his worst. He, until The Dark Knight Rises, didn't seem to comprehend how to film a good fight scene. So I find not so much, I think the Batman saving the doctors makes sense. It's coherent enough. But in terms of quality, in terms of, as I've said a ton, hand-to-hand fighting, in terms of like a big third act blowout, like this is the last big fight, It's not exactly what I want to see, but that's only intact. In theme, it's all there. It's just only in the literal sense. And this is a blind spot of his that's been pointed out in tons of films. He overcuts a lot. While, again, it's still coherent in terms of you could follow what's going on, the aesthetics of it is a little choppy. But that's it. That is literally the one bad thing that I have to say. That's it.
That's fair. And I think mine, again, is in the same vein in that we are saying bad things about a movie we ultimately love. And mine would be that Heath Ledger is so good and so compelling that the movie drags a little bit when he isn't on screen, especially over that last maybe 25 minutes or so. It's like having the best hitter in the MLB in your three hole and then not really having a great lineup around him. It's not quite that dramatic, but that's kind of how I compare it and picture it, a bit of a deflation when he's not just chewing scenery and pushing the plot forward. That's not a knock on Dent, like we discussed, probably an underappreciated element, but man, I mean, you know, come to the theater, we pay to see the elephants, you know?
Yeah. Yep. That's fair.
So, but then again, that is a nitpick. And even though we've kind of splooged love all over The Dark Knight today, we're going to add a little bit more. What is the nicest thing you can say about this movie?
It is the definitive comic book film. I don't think that there's a doubt. Despite the fact that Endgame may have more of a larger fandom, I think that The Dark Knight, when it comes down to it, if you were to poll comic book film fans, you would get a resounding, this is the GOAT. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is the MJ. Nobody doubts that fact. There is no debate. I don't want to hear any bullshit. This is the GOAT. Not just that, but it's one of the best films of my lifetime, period, the end. I think that its closest comparison is Heat, which is like a crazy thing to say, which is what you said, but that's the type of film that it is. The last hour and a half are some of the most propulsive third act I think I've ever seen. I mean, it's an entire film's worth of climaxes, which is incredible. And then, of course, there's Heath, which, you know, he was only 28 at the time, which is actually older than I am.
So young, man.
So what he could have done pains you to think about. It does. It pains you to think about, because
he was really just coming into his own as, like, arguably the best actor of the moment.
What I think about is that right now he'd be like 40. He'd be in his prime. Like, now he would be in his acting prime right now. 12 years later, after The Dark Knight, Heath would be 41, and he would probably have another Oscar by now, because you would think that he would only be getting A-list pick of the hat roles.
Would have been fascinating to see that career unfurl. And, you know, my job, I like to cover the industry, kind of the X's and O's, and to see that progress, especially in today's kind of movie marketplace, it would have been fascinating.
I think that he would have been that rare star who could balance serious drama, but then he would be like an MCU guy. Like you could have gotten him jacked up and cast him as Thor. You know, like, this is the type of guy that he could have been. It's a tragic loss. Really? It is, in terms of what we do, and as you just said, in terms of the what could have been in life, in the film world, in the TV world, this is probably the definitive what could have been of my lifetime. Now, all that said, what he left us before he went, I've said it a few times, it transcends acting. He inhabits that character so wholly that he disappears into it completely. You could show people that film in 30 years and be like, this is how you become the character. This is acting at the highest, highest level. And for that, he will last forever.
Mic drop for Eric Italiano right there. Dude, that was a great tribute, man. I feel like I want to go, like, hit the gym or something after that. Fucking America, baby.
That's my boy right there, man. That's my boy. Because I remember I was, so 2008, I was 15 or 16 at the time. And I remember where I was when I found out he died. And that, of course, as we've talked about, not on this pod, but on past pods, his death, of course, built into the, like, there's a part of me that thinks it may not have crossed $1 billion if he didn't die. Like, that was almost part of the selling point towards the end. Like, not only is it
mythology and the narrative around the movie.
Yeah. Not only is it a transcendent performance, but it's his last. He's gone. This performance is like the most glorious send off that one could have in terms of on screen. Like, I mean, there's James Dean, who is like the guy when this sort of what could have been comes to mind. But yeah, in our lifetime, he's our James Dean.
Now, for me, the nicest thing I think I can say about The Dark Knight is that Hollywood is a copycat league, and this movie ushered in a paradigm shift in terms of how superhero material could be delivered. We've both compared it to Heat. I want to make one other comparison now. It does, upon rewatch, remind me a little bit of Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible, in that it was a very singular, bold, unique vision that was applied to commercial material to kind of produce the best of both worlds. A filmmaker-driven feature that was also wide enough to play as a blockbuster, which is not easy to do. And in both those cases, they elevated the genre and demanded better of what popcorn entertainment could be. And that is kind of a legacy The Dark Knight will always hold.
Yep. And to this day, as I just said, I still think it's the GOAT. I don't think anything has come close on a...
Everything
on,
level?
On, right. But on a scale in terms of pure drama, has achieved what this film has.
So this next question works better for more divisive titles, because here we both know what it's going to be. If you catch this on cable, are you watching?
Well, oh, yeah. Of course. I mean, but just to delve into that a little more, I think that this is like the reigning champ of those films.
Yes.
Like, okay. Of like the Saturday at 4 p.m. on TNT, AMC type vibe. If you see that this is on, you're like, fuck it, I'm watching. I have Absolutely. To. Yeah.
At any point in the movie, too. Like, it could be the beginning bank robbery scene, amazing. It could be the middle where Joker's just getting started meeting with the gangsters, amazing. It could be the end where him, you know, he's holding the Joker off the roof, being like, oh, I gotcha. I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, you know, it's 20 minutes left. I gotta catch the rest of this.
Yeah, so it's the reigning champ, watch this on cable. No question.
Now, before we go, just to wrap up this entire conversation, is there any cool trivia or fun facts you want to hit us with for The Dark Knight? Because I got a couple.
I've got a few super cool ones too. Do you want to go first or?
All right, yeah. I just got two that I'll get out quick. One is funny. One's a little bit more serious. While filming the chase scene with the Joker and the SWAT team, you know, under the bridges, one of only four IMAX cameras in the world at the time was destroyed during the filming of that scene. So imagine being the camera guy and going back to your bosses that day and being like, hey, so don't freak out. Something happened.
But about that one in four camera that we have, yeah.
Like, you know, I know it's a revolutionary piece of technology, but it's also destroyed. But thankfully, you know, Christopher Nolan and, you know, to another extent, Michael Bay have really kind of popularized this IMAX filmmaking. So as expensive as those cameras were back then, and they were, you know, worth more than you and I will ever make in a single lifetime, they were replaced, thankfully. So that's good. And then my second one, which is a bit more serious, Ledger had met with Nolan when he was casting Batman Begins to talk about the role of Bruce Wayne in Batman. They both mutually decided that he wasn't right for that kind of central hero role. But after that meeting, Nolan from then kept Ledger in mind for the Joker. And although he did meet with other actors, because, you know, you just got to cast a wide net in these situations, many of them were reluctant to take the role because of Jack Nicholson's performance and the kind of aura around the character. And ultimately, he chose Ledger because that was his guy from day one. But the reason he chose him, and I quote simply, he's fearless. That's what Nolan said. And I just think that is such a cool summation that, wow. You know, Jack Nicholson didn't bother him. The iconicness of the character didn't bother him. You know, the internet trolls that were starting to spring up around superhero material didn't bother him. Fearless.
Yeah. Awesome. Great call, too. I mean, because at the time, he was known for what? Brokeback and ten
he was an Oscar nominated actor before this, so it wasn't like he was some Joe Schmo, but as we saw with the immediate reaction, he was not thought of as Joker material.
Right, yeah. Phenomenal casting. All right, so mine are, first, this is the first Batman film to not have the word Batman in its title, and that's because it's called The Dark Knight. William Fichtner is in that first scene.
Yeah.
What the hell? Like, that's...
Any idea who you're stealing from?
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. He's so good. And so, like, the first time you see it, you're like, oh, this guy's going to be in this. Nope. Just in that one scene, which is a flex. Huge flex.
He's a that guy character actor, where you don't... The average moviegoer probably doesn't know his name, but you're like, oh, that guy from Armageddon's in this? Cool.
For sure. So the ending of Batman Begins, where Gordon and Batman meet on the roof to talk about this new villain called Joker, that is pretty much a direct rip from the ending of Year One.
And the best future sequel setup tease in history of all this, you know, superhero material, shared cinematic universes, whatever you want to call it, that's the best one that's ever been done. Get the fuck out of here with that BVS, you know, email download attachment shit.
So that's pretty much a scene for scene rip. And I remember that, seeing this for the first time with my dad and just being like, holy shit, it is such a mic drop. In an early draft of the script, it was going to be a two-film arc where the third film would see Dent putting Joker on trial, and then the Joker would have scarred Dent's face during trial, and that would have been the birth of Two-Face, which harkens back to the Long Halloween, because he gets his face scarred in court by having some sort of chemical thrown on it. Heath, when they film that scene where he explodes hospital, it was supposed to just explode as he walks off, but it didn't at first. So the way he like reacts and like looks around and looks confused, that was all improv, which is fantastic.
I always love that, because he stays in character and it's so bewildering and funny and dark and psychological and crazy.
Yeah. The scene where Dent has a gun pulled on him in court is a nod to the Long Halloween. That's how his face gets scarred. I just brought that up. Nolan loves planes. The Dark Knight, China, plane. The Dark Knight Rises. There's that plane scene. The first scene's a plane scene. Dunkirk, a third of the movie is about a plane. Tenet, he explodes a plane. Interstellar is about space traveling planes. This man loves planes. I couldn't believe it.
I literally never put any of that together, but this dude loves planes. Holy shit.
Yep.
What happened when he was a kid where he's like, yo, this is my jam from now on?
Planes. I'm a big fucking plane guy. Hey, guys, I'm Chris. I'm a huge plane guy. All right, bro.
I'm
whatever you say.
Very pro AD.
And that's it. Those are mine.
Those are some good fun facts, Eric.
Thank you, Brandon.
All right, well, if you guys want to know more about our thoughts on The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan, Dune, everything we talked about, you can check us out, brobible.com for Eric, observer.com for me, or follow the podcast on Twitter at postcredpod. Eric, you want to leave them with one final note on The Dark Knight?
Well, yes. Hope that the Batman is half as good.
And definitely be sure to tune in to our next Nolan Deep Dive podcast, where we are tackling Inception. Cue the sound effect. Yes, thank you.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's all.
All right. Beautiful.
Gotta love the whole conversation about the dog.
Make him an offer, Captain.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.